Okay, so the Gemara in Suvas on Daf Nun Vav Amud Aleph has a machlokis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda whether you can make a tanai when you get married v'shas kiddushin that there should be no obligation to provide your wife with sher ksus ve'ona. Can you do that or not? Is that a problem of masna mashikasa betova that we would say that the tanai is nachal? Well, do you have the ability to make such a tanai? We'll focus on sharing ksus, which are in yanim that are in the mumminous realm of items that would need to be furnished in terms of food and clothing. Ona is in a different category, halacha lemaise, but at least in terms of sharing ksus. So we have the machlokis there that according to Rabbi Yehuda, such a tanai can be made. And according to Rabbi Meir, you can't do it because it's masna mashikasa b'tovah tanai batel. So the halacha in this machlokis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda is like Rabbi Yehuda. The Beis Yosef brings that in Siman Lamed Ches that we hold the kol tanai sheba mamon kayam, that if the husband stipulates with respect to one of his monetary obligations towards his wife, b'shas kiddushin, that he shouldn't be obligated, then he's not obligated. With respect to Ona, Rashi says that's a different category because that's considered to be davar shebeguf, because it would cause tsar to the goof of the wife not to have the mitzvah of Ona, and therefore tanai can't be made with respect to a davar shebeguf, only with respect to a davar shebemamon. What if the person doesn't say Amanach she'ein lachalai sher ksus ve'ona? He says Amanach she'ein lachalai din sher ksus ve'ona. What if he says the whole din of sharing ksus is not going to be applicable to me? Does that make a difference? So the Mishnah Melech says that makes a difference, that you can't make it tonight. Even the way we paskin, according to Rabbi Yehuda, if you make it tonight, neged din sher ksus ve'ona, so that doesn't work. And the Ktos HaChoshen and Simon Reish Tes Sif Katon Yud Aleph disagrees with the Mishnah Lamelech and explains what the machlokus is based upon. He says the Mishnah Lamelech is relying upon the Shita of the Rashba, which is brought in Ksuvah Stav Nun Vav Amud Aleph in the Shita Mikubetzis. The Rashba says that the whole basis that one is allowed to make a tanai, a mashikasuv b'tovah, is that you have the ability to be mochel your zechuyos. A person has a schus, and he can be mochel his schus, because he's the bialim on his whatever schus comes to him that he can be mochel. So then you understand, a person can be mochel his schus, but he can't be mochel the din. He's not the bialim on the din. It's like the Tosfos in Ksuvah stuff, Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph, that in order to make a tanai, you'd have to be the bialim. So if it's all a question of having the bialim to be Meichel Eskus, so you can be Meichel Eskus, but you can't be Meichel Adin. The Ksos says that he holds like the Ramban. The Ramban's reasoning as to why it would be permissible to be Masna Mashikasu, Babatova Bidova Shibamamun. The Ramban is in Baba Basra, Tap Kufcha Bav. And the Ramban says that the various shibudim of the Torah only become chal meritzono shel hasheni. Ein adam mishtabi l'chaveiro ela meritzono shel hasheni. So if there's a particular shibud that you would have towards somebody, and the other person says, I have no interest in that shibud, so the shibud never becomes chal in the first place. So this, he says, could be applicable to a din as well. It's not like you're saying the din doesn't exist. The din gives the right to create certain shibudim, but those shibudim are not going to go into effect unless the other person wants it. So the wife says, it's okay. I don't need a sher ksus, I'll take care of myself. So therefore, it doesn't matter whether you say amanah she'ein lachalai or amanah she'ein lachalai din sher ksus. It's just not going to go into effect because the shibud is not going to go into effect. Now, according to both the shita of the Rashba and the shita of the Ramban, we understand why somebody wouldn't be able to make a tanai bedavar she'eino shel mamon if it's bedavar shel iser. Because if I hold that you have to be the bialim, you're certainly not a bialim with respect to the Isurei HaTorah. And if the idea is that the shibud is not going to be chal, the person wants the shibud to be chal, here as well, it's not a question of fulfilling your desire in terms of the shibud being chal, a person might not be interested in any of the Yisurim of the Torah, even if a person, the whole idea of the Yisurim of the Torah is that a person is supposed to say, I don't want the Yisur. Efshi, I want to violate, you know, all of these things, but I'm stuck because the Torah tells otherwise. So therefore, if you're stuck, you have to continue to be stuck. The Shulchan Aruch in Eben Ezra, Siman Samech Tes Siv Vav, says that there are three cases that are yotzim in a klal when a husband gets married to his wife, three things that he's not allowed to make a tanai about. So one of them we already mentioned. One of them is onasa. He can't make a tanai that he'll have no chi of ona. Rashi had explained that it's tzar aguf, some discussion about whether that can be monetized somehow, but that's how we assume lahalacha. The second is ikar haksuva, that a husband is obligated to pay a ksuva, take on a ksuva obligation in the event that he divorces his wife or he predeceases his wife. The ksuva is made up traditionally of two components, but there's really only one essential component. That's the ikar ksuva is the essential component that a besula gets masayim zuz, a beula gets meir zuz. There's the tosefes ha-ksuva that we typically add in our modern-day ksuvas. We add Masayim Zekukim Kesef for a Besula. We add Meya Zekukim Kesef for a Be'ula. I believe Rabbi Willig has already spoken about how we quantify the value of those amounts. But with respect to the Ikar HaKesuva, that's something which is completely non-waivable. And the third is Yerushas Habal, is the ability of the husband to yarshin his wife. That's a halacha, that a husband yarshins his wife is a machlokis in the Gemara. Whether this is the Araisa, whether this is the Rabbanan, that he yarshins his wife, it's a machlokis haposkin, whether we paskin, that it's the Araisa, or whether it is the Rabbanan. There are different drashos from which are derived that he would that a husband would yarshin his wife. But a husband doesn't have the ability to waive his right to, according to the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Samach Tes, we'll see that's not an absolute prohibition, but as a general rule, a Yerusha is Baal Korcho, Shel Adam, right? That we say Baal Korcho Ata Nolad, Baal Korcho Ata Mes, Baal Korcho Ata Yorish, that a person, just added that part, that a person Yarshin, so whether he likes it, whether he likes it or not, and therefore he can't waive his ability to Yarshin. So what many couples do nowadays, we speak all the time about prenuptial agreements. And stam, prenuptial agreement in contemporary parlance, is a reference to, at least in the halakhic community anyway, is a reference to various forms of halakhic prenuptial agreements that protect a wife from becoming an aguna, whether it's they say so explicitly or not. It generally consists of submitting to the jurisdiction of a particular bezdin to adjudicate any disputes that might arise with respect to the giving of a get, as in Rav Moshe Feinstein's formulation in Eben Ezra Chelek Dalet Simin Kuf Zayin, I think, and maybe Kuf Vav. And also sometimes a monetary component that the husband obligates himself to pay a certain amount of support every single day until the couple is no longer married according to Jewish law. So when we speak about prenuptial agreements, we speak about those types of agreements, and there are different forms of how monetary obligations can be made in a way that they won't be a smachta, the way that they won't be a gemeusa. That's, you know, a major part of the discussion. But there are also couples who enter into another type of conventional prenuptial agreement, the type that lawyers are more familiar with, what we call the non-halachic prenuptial agreement. It's a very common and standard, especially for second marriages, when the parties are coming in with all kinds of assets from their previous lives. And they sometimes have children from previous marriages. And in the event that this marriage doesn't work out, or in the event that one spouse predeceases the other, they don't want the other one to get all of the money. So they write all kinds of carve-outs. Included in those carve-outs are very often provisions which state unequivocally that the assets of each side will remain their own and will never go over to the other person. So at the time of a death, and neither party will inherit each other. and that neither party will have the right to take from the other one's assets in terms of even one penny of support. So one thing that couples who enter this type of prenuptial agreement often don't think about is these clauses have halakhic implications. We just got through saying that there are two absolute no's when it comes to making tanaim. One is waiving any ability of the wife to receive something upon death or divorce from the husband, the ikar ksuva, and the other is that the husband does not have the automatic right to or ability to waive the Yerusha that he would receive from his wife. And yet in many of these prenuptial agreements, that's exactly what happens. So the question is, how can these problems be addressed or rectified from a perspective? So with respect to the question of the Ikar HaKsuva, so why is it that we don't allow a waiver? After all, it is a Tanai Sheba Mamun. I mean, that's a monetary application, the Ksuva. So if we, in fact, paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, so why is it that we don't allow it? So the answer is, in part, that in this case, we paskin like Rabbi Meir, but we paskin like a different Rabbi Meir, namely the Rabbi Meir, who says in Ksuva Stap Nundalan Mudbeis and Nunvavam Mudbeis, Sha'asa Lishosim Ishtabal Iksuva. There's an absolute Isser for a person to be with his wife unless there's a ksuba waiting for her in the event of divorce, and possibly in the event of death as well. Pashtus is in the event of divorce or of death, that she has to have the reassurance that she's going to be able to collect the ksuba. Why is that? This takana was made, shlote kalabein of lehotzia, as the Gemara says on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis, that it should not be a lighthearted thing for a husband to divorce his wife. Well, no, that he has to pay this amount of the ksuva. You'll say, no, so what's so bad? Have them enter into this condition, the prenuptial agreement, and guess what? The Tanai will be batel. You just got through saying that Tanai doesn't work with respect to these three things. So what happens if the Tanai is batel? Tanai batel, ma'isav kayim. So everything will be hanky-dory. She'll get to collect her ksuva anyway. So the answer is that, as the Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Samach Vav Sif Tes, that she's not going to have smichas das. Once she doesn't have smichas das, then tiyak bilaso bilas nosa. Then their living together is going to be considered to be bilas nosa. Therefore, that could be a very serious problem. So why is it lemaisa that we say in this case that based on the takanas, Rabbi Meir, that the Tanai, in fact, would be batel, but we just have this problem that the because she won't have smichas das, therefore the bilaso will be bi'ilas nus. So there are two different explanations that are given. One explanation is born in the Bar HaGola. If you look, he's quoting, but it's a good source for finding in Siman Samach Vav Sipkot and Pei, which is that in this case, with respect to the ksuva, chachamim asu chizik ledivreim yotem mishel Torah, that once that there was this takana made, shlote kala be'enav lehotzia, so chachamim made a greater chizik. They said, even though if it would have been a requirement, a mamonis requirement on a deraisa level, you could have made a tanai and the tanai would be kayim. In this case, where we institute ksuva d'rabbanon, generally assume ksuva is d'rabbanon, we go a step further and we say that we're going to make, sometimes we make a chizik on a d'rabbanon level, kishel Torah. In this case, we're making a chizik yotem mishel Torah. For a regular mamonis din on a deraisa level, you can make a tanai, it will be kayim. But this mamonis din on a d'rabbanon level, if you make the tanaim, it's going to be batel because chachamim asu chizik ledivreim. Or the pashtus is like the Lecha Mishnah writes in Hilchos Ishus Perek Yud Beis Halacha Vav, that the reason why the tanai doesn't work is for the reason that we just mentioned earlier. This is not a davar shebe mamon; it's a davar shebe iser. Since it's a davar shebe iser, based on the iser lishosi misha balik suva, so that's the reason why the tanai is not kayim. Okay, now. What then happens with respect to these prenuptial agreements? Maybe you can argue that if a woman enters into a prenuptial agreement and with the lawyers sitting around the table before they're about to get married, I had a case like this in the Bezin. There was a girl, it was a first marriage. a girl from a very wealthy family, the first marriage. It took a long time for her to find her chassan. He finally found someone. He wasn't exactly from the same cultural background, shall we say, of the rest of her families. They got along very well and beautifully, but there was a little bit of nervousness that the assets should be protected. So her family insisted on entering into a regular prenuptial agreement. I remember that they came at the time to the Beis Din that we should help out to ensure that the prenuptial agreement that they entered met with all halachic specifications. So sometimes it could even be a first marriage. So let's say they enter into the prenuptial agreement that says the wife waives her right, that both parties waive their right to receive anything. In this case, the wife would be happy to say that since the husband, the mamish, had no money whatsoever. But she'd be happy to waive her rights as long as he waived his right. So if she waives her right to receive anything, say upon divorce or after the death of the husband, and then 5 days later, they go for the chuppah v'kiddushin, and at the chasen stish, the husband enters into the obligation of the ksuva. So maybe you could say that the ksuva supersedes the previously signed document, and even though she waived everything else, he entered into a ksuva obligation, and you can't waive prospectively is going to, then be agreed upon by the parties afterwards. That will be deemed as superseding previous documents, and therefore the later ksuva document overrides, at least in terms of the ksuva, the waiver of everything else. So this question came up in a New York court in 1974. It was a case called In Re Estate of White. And what happened was that White, I guess, died, the husband, and the Amana came forward that she wanted to collect her ksuva. She wanted to collect the amount of the ksuva. It was a little bit of a question. How do you translate 200 zuz and 200 zakukim and so forth? But she said she wants to be able to collect it, and they came in front of the judge. And the husband's heirs said, well, they signed this prenuptial agreement in which she waived the right to receive anything. And she argued, but after we signed the prenuptial agreement, the next day he entered into the ksuva, and therefore it should supersede the prenuptial agreement. And the judge in the case ruled that it's clear that this was just meant to be a religious hocus-pocus document, because it wasn't written with all the legalities in English and with witnesses. It had the witnesses, but didn't have the party sign it themselves. So the judge said that since the prenuptial agreement, even though it predated the ksuva, was written in English and with all of the legalities and with a clear intent that this be a binding and sustained and sustainable document, therefore the ksuva is just going to be viewed as a ceremonial religious piece of paper, but has no legal effect whatsoever. So it comes out that if, in fact, the woman would appear before a court, let's say a husband refused to go to Beis Din and didn't sign a prenuptial agreement clause that said that any dispute would be in front of a Beis Din as opposed to a civil court, then there really might be an issue of a lack of smichas das in a case where a couple signs the prenuptial agreement and then enter into a suva afterwards, especially if they're familiar with the court decision in the case of Re Estate of White, that wife would not have the necessary reassurance that she would have the ability to collect the Ikar Ksuva, because the court paskin that she's not allowed under those circumstances to collect the Ksuva. So it would seem that it is very prudent and necessary, even if the Ksuva is going to be signed after the prenuptial agreement that waives everything, that the parties must include within the prenuptial agreement a carve-out for the Ikar Ksuva. That even though the wife is waiving her right to collect anything upon death or divorce, at least with respect to the Ikar Ksuva of 200 zuz, that is not being waived, and that the husband will be obligated to pay. It's very interesting because the Divrei Malkiel in Chelek Dalet Simen Kuf Nun Hei dealt with an almost identical situation. In that case, the husband and wife had also entered into a prenuptial agreement in which they had waived all of their rights to Yerusha. They had waived all of their rights to inherit from each other. And he said, with respect to the husband, so I understand that he has a presumptive halakhic right that he would be allowed to inherit from his wife. Maybe this waives no good based on the fact that a husband can't waive the Yerusha. We'll get to that. However, with respect to the wife, what does it mean? It has no halakhic import for a wife to waive her rights to inheritance, because a wife can, in fact, inherit her husband. It doesn't work that way. So what then is the bir advarim? What then is the meaning of the wife's waiver of her inheritance, that she was waiving the ksuva? So therefore, he said, maybe that's a major problem. So he was malamed schus. He says, we're dealing with amei haaretz, who don't know anything, and presumably it didn't enter into their minds that there's a difference between halacha and secular law. So they're thinking that she does have the right to inherit according to secular law, and it never even entered their mind to think about the ksuba altogether. So therefore, he says, on that basis, there never was a waiver of the ksuba, even though it wouldn't have been valid. But he says it can't be that it was intended that there was a waiver of the ksuba in this particular case. However, one could argue that there are certainly people who are not Amei Haaretz, and they understand very well what they're signing when they sign the prenuptial agreement. This is like, you know, the real document. The ksuva is like, you know, the religious warm and fuzzy document, but this is the real document that's going to govern, and they really have in mind that neither party is going to get anything. So then that's a major problem, because then that really creates a situation in which a husband and wife would be living together without the ksuva, and the bilos would be bilos nus, even though the tanai is not chal. But in terms of her mindset is that she's not getting the ksuva. What about the, yes?
Which court was that in the state of wife? Which court was that?
It was the, I believe, the probate court. I don't remember which county. Sorry.
But it was here in New York?
Yeah, you could look it up. You could Westlaw it or whatever.
But it was here in New York.
It was in New York, 1974. Maybe, what's it called? Surrogates Court, maybe. Yeah. Okay. What about with respect to the Tosefes Ksuva? So the Rama writes in Simon Samach Bav Yud Aleph that no problem. You want to waive the Tosefes Ksuva, you could do so just with one proviso. The waiver must take place before the shiduchin, or at least before the ksivas tanoim that takes place at the time of the shiduchin. Once there is a ksivas tanoim, so then it's understood the ksivas tanoim incorporates an obligation to comply with all of the minhagim with respect to the ksuva, which would include the classical ikar ksuva as well as the tosefes ksuva. And after that point in time, there can no longer be a waiver of the tosefes ksuva. So therefore, if parties are going to have tanoim, I don't think that many people have tanoim nowadays before the chuppah, it's very important that if the Tosefes Ksuva is going to be waived, and they just want to, because that already, you're talking real money. Talking about the Ikar Ksuva, some of the stomach, you're not talking about such real money. We'll discuss a little bit in a moment. But the Tosefes, for sure you're talking about real money. I think that, I don't remember, I recently calculated the Rav Moshe amount is, I don't remember, something in the 20,000s, 23, 27,000, something in that range where it stands right now. That's already more significant money. So it's very important that the waiver take place before the tanoim. So one possible bifurcation that might be suggested based on the Chelkos Mechokek in Simen Sarivov, Sif Yud Aleph, the Chelkos Mechokek based on a Mordechai, in Perek Nara Murasa Simen Kuf Samach Gimel, suggests that maybe this whole problem of Lo Samcha Daita, of Asa Lishoy Simeisha Balik Suva, is only talking about the eventuality of Gerishin, but not the eventuality of Misa. Because what's the concern of Shlote Kalab Ein of Lotzia? That's Lotzia, if he's going to divorce her. But if it's not going to be a divorce, but rather it's upon his debt, so then there's no problem of Mechila Saksuva, or Mechila Saksuva, writes the Mordechai. And therefore, there's the suggestion, and the Divrei Malkiel mentions this as well, that parties, if they wanted, perhaps, could enter into a prenuptial agreement, which the wife says, upon divorce, I still get the ksuva, but upon death, then I would get absolutely nothing, and that might still be okay. The Divrei Malkiel points out that not everyone agrees to this, and therefore it should not be relied upon, and the main reason not to rely upon it is based on the Tosfos in Ksuvos and Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis, the very Gemara that talks about the foundation of the Ksuva being Shlotei Kala Beinav Lotzia. So Tosfos asks the question, no, then I understand why you need a Ksuva for divorce, but why do you need a Ksuva for Misa? So Tosfos answers, no, you need a Ksuva for Misa as well, based on Chinah. Should get the women to be willing to get married because they know that they're going to get something. So Tosfos knows, if not for the fact that we were misakin aksuva in the case of divorce based on Shlotei Kala Beinav Lotzia, we wouldn't have introduced this consideration of Chinah. But once we introduce this consideration of Chinah, it becomes just as binding and just as forceful as the Takana of Ksuva in the event of divorce. So based on that Tosfos, it says that once we were misakin it in the case of Misa, even though the consideration of Shlotei Kala Beinav Lotzia is no longer applicable, but it has the same amount of effect and force, so then it stands to reason that the Isser to be poches minaksuva that would create a bitul hatanai, and that would require the requisite smichas das, or else lead to a bi'ilas nos, would be applicable even if there was a waiver in the event of Misa, as well as a waiver in the event of divorce. However, what about the ikar ksuva itself? So you have to ask the question, what's the big deal about the ksuva? She's going to have so much smichas das. What is she getting? At this point in time, she's getting something between, I don't know, $600 and $700 in terms of the value of 200 zuz, which is essentially 50 shkolim. So whatever is pidyon habein amount, you just multiply it by 10, and that's what the ikar ksuva comes out to. So why should people feel such a sense of reassurance that they're getting such a tiny amount? So I saw in the Sefer Ksuva Kehilchasa, he quotes from the Rivash in Simen Kuf Nun Dalet, saying, you think everybody is rich? There are poor people too. For poor people, this amount is in fact meaningful. Every single amount is meaningful. So, Mistama, that's also true that nobody knows quite how wealthy they're going to be at any moment in time. Aneas is a Gilgul Achoze Ba'olam, that a person could be rich today and made off tomorrow. So there's always the possibility of people losing their fortunes at smichas das to know that at least they'll get something that would put a poor person at ease. Could be. But what if the parties say, look, we're worried because we really don't want any substantial sum to go to the other side. And if this gets adjudicated by Beis Din, who knows, maybe somebody's going to show up and pull off a Rav Duchovsky shita and say that the Masayim Zuz should be evaluated based on the Mishnah and the Yerushalmi and Peah, that constitutes 1 year's sustenance, and maybe 1 year's sustenance will be calculated based on the amount of the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement as $55,000 or something like that. And then you're talking a very significant amount of money. So maybe it would be a good idea in such cases for parties to stipulate in their ksuva that in their prenuptial agreement that we're excluding the amounts of the ksuva which should be payable, but the amounts of the ksuva should be evaluated based on the opinion of Chaim Noah or some shita where they know that it's going to not be evaluated as a significant amount based on whatever the price of silver is worth at that point in time. My only concern with that particular approach is, let's say they're wrong, meaning halacha is not something that you get to pick and choose from. When a Beis Din paskins, they're paskining based on what objectively they think the value of the ksuva should be. The halacha is that even if you're poches min haksuva, that would be considered to be a bi'ilas nus if the wife isn't going to get the full 200 zuz. And therefore, let's say that it's determined that however they chose is not a shita that's accepted la halacha. Can you say kimli for purposes of avoiding an iser of a bi'ilas nus and being poches min haksuva? The answer is, I'm not sure. I'm raising this because I'm not sure what the answer is. But maybe the better approach is for them to choose a Beis Din that they're comfortable with and say that if there is any question about how to evaluate the 200 zuz, we agree that it should be adjudicated by the following Beis Din, that they trust to come up with whatever would be a reasonable amount. Maybe it could be some sort of a combination that we'll do whatever the Bezin says would apply, but to the degree that it's possible for us to stipulate that it should be the lowest possible sum, then we do so. Possible pshara. Now, what's more complicated on some level, yes, I'm sorry.
Just a little question, I'm just curious because I've not had contact with this. You know, I've had contact with the other. A court of appeal judge once told me that, look, bottom line is, we, as a judge, we look at the situation, the merits, and we try to do what's right. And, you know, within the limits of the parameters that the law allows us to do. So I'm just wondering, when we're talking about drafting a prenuptial agreement to achieve certain halakhic results, whether whether it's possible to lose sight of the fact that, and does this happen in a Bezdin, that they're going to take the same kind of approach that a judge might say, hey, bottom line is, I'm going to be sensitive to the merits of the situation. I'm going to find the halakhic within the halakhic parameters, make a decision that feels right.
What's the danger that you're contemplating? I'm just trying to understand.
Well, I'm just wondering if one loses sight in the drafting of choosing particular halakhic ramifications of the nuptial agreement, whether that's really relevant. Because the fact is, the merits of the situation may be overriding. And if
the prenuptial agreement, putting on my legal hat for a sec,
yeah.
If the prenuptial agreement explicitly says that everything is waived other than the amount of the ksuva, so there's no reason at all that any judge wouldn't honor that. They would be taken seriously, just like
the value of the ksuva.
You say value of the ksuva of 200 zuz as assessed by the betin of blank.
Okay.
That I think would be completely binding. Yeah. What's a more complicated inyan is the mechila of the Yerusha, of the husband's ability to be mochel the Yerusha's habal. So we said this is one area. The Shulchan Aruch says explicitly the husband can't be mochel. So we have to understand why can't he be mochel, and to what extent can he be mochel. What we're going to see is that sometimes the husband can be mochel. This is not an absolute rule. This is a rule that once they are already married, once there has already been nisuin, so then he doesn't have the ability to be meichel after the time of nisuin api pashtus, but it does not necessarily include the period of time prior to nisuin, or at least not the entire period of time prior to nisuin. What's this all about, not being able to be meichel? You make a tnai on the Yerusha. So part of this is that as a general rule, parties are not allowed to make a tanai b'yerusha. As I mentioned at the beginning, al korcho at yoresh, that you can't get out of it. But there is a machlokis, actually, in the Mishnah, in Ksuvus and Daf Pei Gimel Amud Aleph, between Tanakama and Maman Shimon Ben Gamliel, as to whether a husband is allowed to make a tanai to be mesalik himself, to remove himself. And there's a little bit of, I don't want to say inconsistency, but ambiguity, shall we say, as to whether these two lashonos go together or whether these are two different lashonos, whether tnai luchu is siluk luchud, or whether tnai and siluk go together. That ambiguity really remains through the codification of the halacha. It's not an ambiguity that's ever definitively removed, which Tosfos is already there. On the daf makes reference to. So there's a question as to whether it's considered to be masna mashikosav b'toyra or whether it's not. And the assumption of the machlokas there is that if it would be considered to be masna mashikosav b'toyra, then the tanai would be batil. So Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says this is masna mashikosav b'toyra, and the tanai is batil, and therefore a husband can't make a tanai not to be yorish his wife. And Rav in the Gemara, paskins like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, v'lav mitaimei, but the v'lav mitaimei has little bearing on the general question as to whether a person can make a tanai in Yerusha or not, because the point is that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel holds that Yerusha Sabal is deraisa, and you can't make a tanai in a deraisa, and Rav holds that Yerusha Sabal is derabbanan, even though it's only derabbanan, you still can't make a tanai. But either way, Rav is paskening like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. So the whole thing is a little bit mind-boggling. Why is the whole thing a little bit mind-boggling? Because we started our whole discussion today saying that as a general rule, we hold like Rabbi Yehuda. They're called Tanai Shiva Mamun Kayim. So why should Yerusha Sabalu, Yerusha in general, be any different? In fact, the Rif says, well, this is wrong. The Rif wouldn't have subscribed to the halacha that we quoted in Shulchan Aruch at the beginning, that you make an exception for the Tanai of the Baal not to be Yerush. The Rif says, this is a regular Dovah Shibim Mamun, and therefore we paskin against Mamun Shibim Gamliel. We paskin like the Tana Kama, that of course the husband can make a Tanai to be Mesalik himself from the Yerusha of his wife. Is that true in general? Do we generally allow a person to make a Tanai that they won't be able to inherit, or that somebody won't inherit from them? We'll assume for the moment that if I make, I'm the Moish, and I make the Tanai that somebody shouldn't inherit from me, that's only if the person who would receive the benefit is Moichel. But let's say the person is Moichel. The person says, I'll be Moichel, my Yerusha. So can such a Tanai potentially be made? So the truth is that this discussion is in the Gemara in Baba Basra on Daf Kuf Chaf Vav. The Gemara there asks the question, specifically in this context, says that we know that the Tanai, Menashe Ein Loch Alai Sher Ksus V'Oina, works. So, you know, can a Tanai be Yerusha work? And the Gemara says, no, no. The Tanai of Sher Ksus V'Oina, Hasam Kayodu Machla, she knows what she's giving up, and she's giving it up over here. Hachalo kamachil. But here, the Yoresh is not moichel. So the Rashbam indicates very clearly, no, if the Yoresh would be moichel, so then it would be perfectly possible and perfectly feasible for the Yoresh to be moichel. And similarly, the Nemuke Yosef says that all this means simply is that we can't construe a person's shtika as hodah. The implication is that if the person actually spoke up and said that he would be Meichel, that he could be Meichel. But in his first comments, the Nemuke Yosef has two ukimtas on that Gemara. And in his first ukimta, he says this has nothing to do with being Meichel and not being Meichel. It's just that a person who's normally going to be a Yoresh can't be make a Tanai to be Meichel and his Yerusha, because the Schus Yerusha is already in his hands. A person's a son of a father. So as soon as he's born, he already has the Schus Yerusha. So therefore, the only way he can get rid of it is B'mecha or B'matana. But he can't get rid of it B'mecha or B'matana either, because he doesn't have it yet. So he's kind of betwixt and between. And as a result, since it already came to his hands, he can't make it tonight, but he also can't give it away because he doesn't have it yet. So he's kind of stuck. So it's like a technical disqualification as to why it is that somebody is not able to make a Tanai in Yerusha. It has nothing to do with the Gemara. The Rashba and the Baal HaMa'or explain a little bit differently along the lines of the Melitza that we came up with, which is Al Korcho Ata Yoresh, that it's a Milsa de Mimela. Yerusha is a Milsa de Mimela. You have no control over it. Remember, in order to make a Tanai, it's the principle of the Toisos and Suva Zayin Dao that we mentioned earlier. You have to have some bailus. There's no bailus. It's a milsa de memela. It happens by itself. You have no bailus over it. Therefore, mechila doesn't work. Problem is the lashon of the Gemara, just as a point of observation, doesn't say that. Gemara doesn't say that there's no ability to make it tonight. It just says hacha lo kamachio. But there's a hagos on the Gemara, hagos Eretz Tzvi, that quotes a Chacham Echad, who says that he came up with a different girsa in the Gemara in Baba Basa Dav Kof Chavav. And the girsa's Gemara is the Lo Matzi Machil, something like that. You don't have the ability to be Machil. You don't have the ability to make a Tanai with respect to Yerusha. Now that goes to Ashri in Perek Ches, Simen Tesvav, in Sanhedrin, says that this is what the Yerushalmi says, the Ksos, Hachoshin, and Simen Reishai and Ches, Sifkatun Yud Gimel, says, I don't know what Yerushalmi is talking about. I never found such a Yerushalmi that says explicitly that it's completely off limits to be able to be Meichel Yerusha to make a Tanai. We all came up with good reasons. Mukhi Yosef came up with a good reason. Rashba came up with a good reason, and we'll hold that way, la halacha, but you got to try to cite this from the Gemara, that's not something which you would be able to pin this on the Gemara, because the Gemara doesn't actually say it. The truth of the matter is that I'll try to be a little bit innovative over here. I think that I may have found the Yerushalmi that says it, the Yerushalmi in Ksuvos, you know, it's also in Sanhedrin, that deals with this whole parsha of Yerusha Sabal, says that we paskin like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, namely that the Yerusha cannot be waived, but then the Yerushalmi gives an editorial note. Now, if the editorial note would come from a Rishon, I wouldn't be able to pin this on the Yerushalmi. But the Yerushalmi makes the editorial note itself. It says, not for the reason that the Yamasna Mashikasu B'Torah, because this is a Tanai Shemamomon. We all know that Tanai Shemamomon, you can make such a Tanai. It's just a Shekfar Zochabo. It's that the husband has already been Zoche in the Yerusha. When he got married to his wife, he already had the schus, and you can't get rid of something that you already have through a Tanai. Would only be through actually giving it away. You just can't do it, even if he wanted to do it. So granted, it doesn't say explicitly you're never allowed to make a Tanai B'davar Shebe Yerusha, but it's essentially spelled out by the Yerushalmi. So I want to suggest that maybe this is the Yerushalmi that was being alluded to by the Agos Ashri. However, we're not up to that yet. The Yerushalmi very clearly is at least talking about Nesua, or really only talking about, I'll be honest with you, that particular line of the Yerushalmi doesn't really make sense, unless we say you're talking about Nesua, because he doesn't have the right to inherit his wife while he's only an Arusa. That's one of the three things that only comes into the domain of the husband at the point in time in which the Nisuin takes place, right? Okay, the others is Tumas Kohanim and to be Metamila, and the other is in Hafaris Nedareh, you know, by and Hafaris Nedareh. Okay, I mean, technically, you can find a little window of time in which it came into his possession, Kodim Nisuin, if you say, well, not if you say, but you could find the window of time when the woman has been handed over Mibes Avia, Leves Baila, and she goes with the Shluchei Habal, even though she hasn't actually come to the Chuppah, so technically speaking, the Schus Yerusha kicks in at that moment in time. So if you wanted, you know, you could potentially say, well, maybe the Yerushalmi is even talking about that period of time. It's not Mochach, that it's not. So, you know, but Pashtus is that you're correct. Okay. Now, that being said, the fact is that the Gemara goes on to say very clearly, quotes Rav Kahana, that Nachla Habal Yodom Imokum Achia Masne Olea Shelo Yirashena, that we have a principle, you have a nachlo that's coming from somewhere else, you can make a tanai. This is not, in fact, an absolute rule. While it might be, as we pointed out in the name of the Rashba, as we pointed out from the Nemuki Yosef, that it might be an absolute rule when it comes to other Yerushos that you can't make a tanai, but with respect to Yerusha Sabal, it is, in fact, not an absolute rule. There is a point in time in which Siluk is Mehani, okay? And, in fact, the Yerushalmi, I quoted to you how it says that we pass them like Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Rishonim point out that there's a steer in the Yerushalmi. The steer of the Yerushalmi also quotes Rabbi Yossi as saying that with respect to the Nedunya that the husband is receiving from the wife's father, that the husband can make a Tanai, that in the event that he dies, the Nedunya is going to return to his father-in-law rather than going to him be Yerusha, which would seem to also indicate that the Yerushalmi paskins that way as well. And in fact, this Shita of Rabbi Yossi is quoted by the Yerushalmi after the Yerushalmi quotes, says in the name of Rav Yirmiyah Marav that the halacha is like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. So you could even argue within the Yerushalmi Tafus Lashon Acharon that it is perfectly permissible for the husband to make a tanai not to inherit from his husband. But some of the Rishonim answer that we can actually be mekayim both of the statements of the Yerushalmi, and there are different ways of doing it. But one way of doing it is saying that the statement in the Yerushalmi, in Paskin Sarka, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, is correct. That normally speaking, a husband has no ability to waive the Yerusha. What then is the case of Rabbi Yossi? The case of Rabbi Yossi is totally different. There's a matana that's being given by his father-in-law. So you can always make a tanai with respect to a matana that it will be like a matana amanas lahachzir. This is with respect to the nedunya that the father is making a private deal with the father-in-law that under certain conditions this will be considered to have never really left your possession. Then in the event that the wife dies, say without any children, so then it will go back to the father-in-law. And some say that this is the mechanism by which the whole takana shum operated. What's the Takana Shum? The Takana Shum, also, this was introduced originally or popularized by Rabbeinu Tam, and then became formalized more as Takana Shum, that if the wife would die within the first year without any children, the Nedunya would go back to the father-in-law. If she died the second year without children, then half the Nedunya would go back. This was changed over years. It was Takanas Teltuya, Takanas Damasik, Takanas Eretz Yisrael, all different variations of this theme. And the Chassam Sofer indicates in Eben Ezer, in Chelek Beis, Simen Kuf Nun Vav, that this is how Rabbeinu Tam got his name. Because there's a klal of Issam Larik Kochachem. So Rabbeinu Tam wanted to ensure that nobody would lose all of their life possessions by giving it to some son-in-law and then have the daughter, Chas V'Sholom, die without any children in the first year of the marriage and then lose all of their possessions. So Rabbeinu Tam, in order to prevent that from happening, introduced this, or as I said, some say it came before, but he popularized this takana, so hence he got the name Rabbeinu Tam based on Misam Lariko Chachem. So this would be a similar type of a principle. So that's a question then as to whether maybe we should really say that the psak is like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. After all, Rav paskin that way, the Yerushalmi paskin that way. So maybe only in the case of the Nedunya you can make a tanai based on a matana, but otherwise the husband doesn't have the ability. However, Lemaisa, the Gemara does say that there is some sort of circumstance where Nachla Bali Yodim and Makum Achim Masna Aleh Shelo Yirashena. So what do we do with that? So the Shulchan Aruch says, and this is fleshed out in Simon Sadi Beis, that the husband has the ability to be Masalik himself, to make this tonight, to be Masalik himself from the Yerusha of his wife, Bein Erisin Lenisuin. Between the time of Erisin and Nisuin, when he does not yet have the Yerusha, so that's when he has the ability to make the Siluk. But Bishas Nisuin itself, he no longer has the ability to make the Siluk at that point in time. So why is it that we allow this exception in the case of the husband, while with every other Yerusha we quoted, maybe we quoted from the Rashba and so forth, that there's no such thing as ever making a tanai? So there are really two different approaches. One approach is that of the Tosfos Rid. Tosfos Rid says, on the Gemara in Ksuvos, you know why this is allowed? Very simple reason. Because Yerusha Sabal, we paskin, is only midrabanan. And this is like the ability of the wife to say yefshi b'takanas chachamim, that she's going to subsist based on her own maisa yadeh, and turn down the mizonos of the husband, which the wife has the right to do. So just like the wife there has the right to say, Efshi betakonis chachamim, that's the comparison that the Gemara makes, so too the husband here is allowed to make the choice, Efshi betakonis chachamim, that I'm going to do without the Yerushas Habal, and therefore we allow him to do it. Now, the Rashba says that the reason why he's allowed to do it is because it hasn't, in this particular case, it's not a milsa de memela. Remember, the whole thing, according to the Rashba, is to why you normally you can't make a Tanai B'Yerusha, it's a milsa de memela. This is a milsa de b'maisa, meaning that the husband has to make an affirmative maisa in order to be qualified to receive the Yerusha, namely, he has to marry the girl. Well, he marries the girl. It's not a milsa de memela. It's a milsa de lemaisa. He has the bialim. The bialim can make the tanai. And if we assume, the explanation given by the Nemuka Yosef, that the problem is that it already came, he already has the schus, at any moment in time he can get it, it's not true. Because prior to Nisuin, he can't get the Yerusha. So then we understand, based on all these different reasons. But according to the Rashman and Nemuka Yosef, I don't have to come on and say that this is different because it's a Takanas Chachamim. Even if Yerusha would be Daraisa, he would be allowed to make this tie. And in fact, the Rashba holds that Yerusha Sabal is Daraisa, and nonetheless, he's still allowed to make this tonight of Bein Erisin Le Nisuin. Based on the Rashba's analysis, that if I have this Yerusha Makom Acher, and it's not a Milsa de Memela, then I have the right to make the tonight. So the Ktsos writes that we could say the same thing as to why a person can make a tanai not to receive the pishnayim, because that's not a milsa de memela, it's a matana, because the Torah says losses lo pishnayim, and the same thing with respect to a yavam, that until he performs the maisa yibum, so then he does not inherit his brother in terms of whatever would have come from the first marriage. He doesn't become the yoyresh, and therefore he could be meichel his right to be yoyresh, the yerushas yavam as well, kodem l'shas yibum, based on these same arguments and considerations. Now, the Ran in Ksuvos, here in Daf Mem Aleph, writes that this period of time that we allow the husband to remove himself from the Yerusha of the wife is very circumscribed. It can only be during this window of time. It used to be a 12-month window, now it's a 2-minute window, especially if there are no speeches under the chuppah. There's a small window of time between Erisin and Nisuin. If it's after Nisuin, it's too late because it's already, as the Lashon of the Yerushalmi, Shekvar Zochabo, it already came into his hands. And as far as before the Erisin, so that's why we say, Lo Meshach Shaykh, Pashaykh Ibe. He has no connection to it. You can't be Meichel on a Dovah Shalom Baal Yoylam that he hasn't even come into his orbit yet. And therefore, it has to be only from the time of Erisin when it's Shayach to him. He just doesn't have it yet. But it can't be after Nisuin, and it can't be before Erisin. It's a very short window of time that we would give him that ability. The Magen Mishnah learns based on the a Tshuvas HaRambam. This is the Magen Mishnah in Perek Chav Gimel, this is how the Rambam learned the sugya, that he broke up the Rishami between the Eris and the Nisuin. The Rishami says the halakha is like Rav Shimon Gamliel. Yeah, the halakha is like Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Rishami is talking about after Nisuin. After Nisuin, the halakha is like Rav Shimon Gamliel. V'lav mitayme, nothing to do with Masna Mashkos to Betoyer. It's because Krasokhabo, and therefore you can no longer be Meichelet. And called the Marison, so that's when we have all these other Tanayim, like the one that was brought by Rabbi Yossi in the Yerushalmi, and that's what the Gemara in Ksuvos is talking about as well, in terms of Rav Kahana's din, Nachla Balam, Aladam, and Makom Acher. When can you say Efshi? Efshi, you could say before something has come into your hands, I don't want this Takanas Chacham. Now, the Chavos Yor asked the obvious question in terms of what we do. He says, there's such a thing as prenuptial agreements. Remember, we were talking about that at some point. There's such a thing as prenuptial agreements, and sometimes people enter into the prenuptial agreements, and they say, the husband waives his right to receive the Yerusha. But nobody's citing it between the Avos and the Nisuin. We have the 300 years ago. 400 years old, they were already having quickie, you know, marriages between Avos and Nisuin. There's nobody citing it during that tiny period of time underneath the chuppah. It's good. It would create more of a hefsek, so, you know, we wouldn't have to draw out the reading of the ksuvah. He says nobody is doing it then. So he's trying to figure out. He tries to be miyashiv, minagoyilim. He has a number of tshuvas that are devoted to this. It starts with Simon Mem Zayin, and then he has a number of tshuvas from Simon Nun to Simon Nun Beis. He brings in Abodas Gershuni, who as a guest writer for his volume, and he has a couple of other tshuvas that he puts together to try to figure this out, and we'll discuss his different etzos. But first, we'll discuss the Rambam. The Rambam is a little bit difficult to figure out. On the one hand, the Rambam writes that Yerusha Sabal is Midivrei Sofrim. Kesef Mishnah notes, well, don't assume automatically that means it's the Rabbanan. The Rambam elsewhere says Midivrei Sofrim, Kesef Kiddushin, and Kenyan Kesef, and he really meant Araisa. But here it appears pretty obvious that he means that he says explicitly it's Midivreim. He talks about Chachamim Asu Chizik LeDivreim in the context of Yerusha Sabal. It seems pretty clear that the Rambam holds that Yerusha Sabal is only Midrabbanan. But you'd figure, okay, so then he may as well just use the Tosos Rid consideration and say the reason you can make the Tanai between the Erisin and the Nisuin is because this is a Yusha Derabbanan. But the Rambam doesn't say that. The Rambam says that the reason you could do it is because this is a Yerusha Shlobam Mishpachto, that is not one that is, shall we say, a Milsa de Mimela, as the Rashba points it. It's not one that comes automatically, and that's why he has the ability to distance himself from it. And in fact, the Magen Mishnah in Chasishas Perichov Gimel points out that you could potentially have two different explanations within the Rambam as to why he allows this. One explanation that it's only Drabbanan, and the other explanation because it's a Dover Shalohigia Liyodo Adayan, and therefore he has the ability to still be Meichelet since it hasn't yet come into his possession. And the Magen Mishnah says clearly the second explanation is more feasible within the Lashon of the Rambam. The Rambam says something, though, which is odd, that we gave all these explanations. We brought a Rashma, we brought a Muki Yosef, I could have thrown in a Ran as well, but different explanations as to why it is that somebody is never allowed to be Michael Yerusha, given that it's a Tanai Shibamomon. The Rambam comes along, and he seems to say something else. You know what? Maybe it's not a Tanai Shibamomon. We said at the beginning that the reason why you can't be Meichel, the Ikar Ksuva, according to the Lecha Mishnah, is because the Dovashiv Isser. Here the Rambam seems to say the same thing. He says, you know why you can't be make a Tanai with respect to Yerusha? He says it's in Hilchos Nachlos. And he says this to explain that we make a chizuk l'divreim with respect to Yerusha Sabal, even though it's not the Araisa, but still we treat it like a Araisa, at least after Nisuin. Why you can't make a Tanai after Nisuin? So he says it's because Yerusha is called Chukas Mishpat. This drasha is not something you're going to find in the Gemara. In the Hago, even the Hagos there at Sri, quoting the Chacham Echad, he may have edited the Gemara a little bit, but he didn't put the words Chukas Mishpat into the Gemara. The one place where the Gemara in Baba Basra gives significance to Chukas Mishpat in the context of Yerusha is in the Kuf Yod Gimel Amud Beis, in the context of if you're going to have a Din Torah with respect to Dinei Yerusha, it has to be only during the daytime, just like other dinim, because it's called Chukas Mishpat. There, it's certainly not in the connotation of reading a Milsa de Isura into the words Chukas Mishpat. But Rambam says it shows the din can't be Yishtana, the din can't change, because it says Chukas Mishpat. It seems that the Rambam is assigning Issa Veheter status to Yerusha. Nobody else does this, but the Rambam actually seems to do this. The Chazon Ish, Evan Ezer, Siman Ayin Zayin, Sifei, says, Ein ze drasha, she'en ha-rishonim darshim mikros, that this is not a drasha, that rishonim have no right to darshim the psukim on their own. It can't be a drasha. So he says it must be that the Rambam really just holds like the Rashba, and he's throwing in a pasuk for good measure. But if the Rambam was holding like the Rashba, then the Rambam will be saying that this is mamash adavar shebemamon. The Rambam seems to be saying that it's a davar shebeiser. It's just that with respect to our takana that we apply the davar shebeiser to the milsa derabbanan Yerusha Sabam, the Rambam says that we only do that after the time of Nisuin and not the time of Erisin. The Griz in his chidushim on the Rambam in Hilchos Nachlos in Perek Vav Halacha Yud makes the following chiddush that according to the Rambam there are tzveidin with respect to any type of Yerusha. One is that you have the dine momnus of the Yerusha. So there is such a thing as a dine momnus. If it would be just a stam dine momnus, you would be allowed to make it tonight. But then there's the second component with respect to chukas mishpat. So a tanai works with respect to the first component of the dine momnus, but it doesn't work with respect to the second component of chukas mishpat. So there, in the Hilchos Nachlos Perek Vav Halachot, the Rambam is talking about the Nachlos Ager, how a ger inherits from his father the non-Jew. So Mida Araisas, once he converted, he doesn't get to inherit from him anymore. Mida Rabbanan, we allow him to inherit, but as a result, says the Rambam, the father, the non-Jew, is allowed to make a Tanai, the son of mine who converted to Judaism, he's not inheriting me. And that Tanai is going to be a valid Tanai. So why is that a valid tanai? So the Ravelbel explains that this is because when this is only a din Yerusha Drabban, and with respect to din Yerusha Drabban, we didn't necessarily always impose this component of Chukas Mishpa. We only impose the component of the Dine Mamonos when it comes to the Yerusha Seger, and therefore a tanai can be made. So it's the same thing, according to the Rambam then, with respect to the Yerusha Sabal, that we only impose the Chukas Mishpa component after Nisuin. So therefore, after Nisuin, no tanai can be made. But Kodim Nisuin, we don't impose it, and therefore a tanai can still be made. Kodim Nisuin. We still have to explain how it is that we have these prenuptial agreements where the husband is able to be mesalik himself in a fashion which is binding from the Yerusha of his wife, or maybe it's not binding, maybe it's not done properly. So there are many, many different approaches to justify the practice of not doing it ben Eris and Nisuin. And then there is the most plausible approach, which is, if you're going to do it, you know what? Do it between Eris and Nisuin. But first of all, look at all the other approaches. So one approach is the Avnei Miluim in Siman Sadi Beis proposes that maybe Tanai really is a stronger Lashon than Siluk with respect to the Yerusha Habal. And therefore, while after Nisuin, maybe it won't work at all because it already is Bali Ado, but before Erisin, where the Ran had written, well, it's not Meshach Shayachi Bey, and therefore he doesn't have the ability to do it, maybe that's only if it's a Lashon Siluk. But it's a Lashon Tanai, maybe it's even stronger. Because Tosfos and Pei Gimel Amin Aleph asks, so why are we just using a Lashon Siluk? What about Tanai? Says the Chiddush is that even Siluk is Mehani. So it sounds like Tanai is even stronger. And then the second explanation of Tosfos is, no, the reason why you need Lashon Siluk is because if he just made it as a Tanai, maybe it would be viewed as Betumei Mili Bialma, that he's just trying to make his wife feel good, but he doesn't really mean it. So therefore, you need the Lashon of Siluk, which shows that he really means it. So it's suggested in the Hagosa of Avnei Miluim over there, this teretz may depend on which one of the terutzim of Tosfos you hold like, as to whether Tanai is stronger than Siluk or is not stronger than Siluk. Or the other suggestion, you find this in Rabbi Akiva Eger and in the Chassam Sofer in different measures. Rabbi Akiva Eger says that we do it, when do we do it? After they're already engaged. So we're not going to enter into prenuptial agreements before they're engaged, or else you have, you know, a major problem on your hands. And he says that since they're already engaged, so already it's Meshach Shaychi Bey, that already there is some type of a connection between the parties that you would be able to harness in order to allow the Siluk to be binding. Or the Chassam Sofer, who says that after, at least after the Tanaim, if they do it after they enter in the Tanaim, so that already is not in the realm of Davash Lo Bal Yoylam, that it would be considered a Mechila B'Davash Lo Bal Yoylam, because that's already what we call a Vidi Dasi. Now, the Chavos Yair doesn't like that suggestion because he says, Avidi Da'asi requires at least that the Shibud is Chal. But the Shibud is not Chal. You're talking about the Erisin. So the Erisin already, the Shibud process has already begun from the Shas Erisin. But here there's no Shibud in place, Kodim Le Erisin, so therefore he doesn't like that. And the Avodas HaGirshuni suggests that you do it in a fashion in which you say, this is like taking Trumos and Maestros, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, relying on the Chazon Ish. I don't know what to do, but whatever it says in the book, that's what I'm doing. So the Avodas HaGirshuni says, you do something similar over here. Say, I know that the way to do it is not the way I'm doing it, but I'm doing it by Ofen HaMoel. It should count as if I'm doing it the right way. Like we have in our prenuptial agreement, not to get us into trouble, I shall be deemed to have repeated this assumption of obligation at the time of our marriage. So it's deemed as if I've done this between Erisin and Nisuin in a way that this should be Chal. Avnei Miluim isn't excited about this because says you want to make like a Kinyan Odisa, it doesn't work with a Dava Shaloba Ali Oilam. And here, if it's a Kodim Le Erisin, then it's still a Dava Shaloba Ali Oilam at the time that he's entering into it. And the next explanation is what the Nachla Shiva utilizes. We rely a lot on the Nachla Shiva. Here, the Nachla Shiva comes under a lot of fire. The Nachla Shiva in Simon Chof has a Shtar Siluk of the husband from his wife's Yerusha, from the Yerusha's Habal that he would get from his wife. And he says, you know when to sign it to avoid all problems? Do it after the Nisuin. Do it after the Nisuin. What's so bad that you don't have the problem that you're not Meshach Shaychi? So you'll say, the Gemara says you can't do it. You do it, Meshach. The Gemara has a whole discussion about maybe you can still do it if it's Kanum Yado. So do it with a Kenyan. Because after all, with respect to the Silo Kabam Naperus, we're asking Kanum Yado. You can do it after Nisuin. Who Adin when it comes to the Yerusha Sabal? And he claims that the Torah holds this way. The problem is nobody holds this way. Shulchan Aruch and Simon Sadi base very explicitly paskins not this way. Even Kanu Miyodul Akhan Nisun only works for Peros, that she can go and sell her Peros without the husband's interference after the Nisun, but does not work for the Yerusha because it's a Tavash Lobo, it hasn't come to Lo Zochel Bo. He hasn't been Zorika that he would be able to give it away, but it's already, he has a schus in it that he wouldn't be able to waive it. So therefore, Kanu Miyodul is not going to work with respect to the Yerusha. The Rambam also very clearly holds this way as well. And even the Torah, who was quoted by the Nachla Shiva in the way that the Torah is interpreted by the Prisha there in Simon Sadi Beis, the Prisha says that the Torah is clearly, if you look very carefully at the Lashon of the Torah, he's only talking about Siluk Miperos, but he's not talking about Siluk Min Yerusha. Of course, that doesn't work. Even the Beis Meir says, I have no idea where the Nachla Shiva got this idea from, and that happens to be very, very problematic. However, the Ramah in Simon Sadi Beis, Siv Zayin, quotes from the Ramban that there is the possibility that a husband can give away his Yerusha. This is brought by the Ran and the Daf Mem Beis Amud Aleph in the Dape Harif, B'Shem HaRamban, that he does have the ability to give away to make a commitment. That when it comes to, he's already married, so he already has a schus in the Yerusha. So he can make a commitment at this point in time that when it comes into his hands, he's going to give it away. So that type of commitment he can make. He says, when it comes into my hands, so then I will give it to my wife's family. So if you use that kind of a lashon, so that would be completely and perfectly binding Medina de Shulchan Aruch, Medina Al-Pi Halacha. That would be another potential way of devising this. And in fact, the Avnei Miluim there in Sifkarten Tezvav is of the opinion that this is really the way that Takana Shum worked. That all the Takana Shum, he says, worked based on this premise. I suggested maybe they all worked on the premise of Matana Menasa Haksir. He says that the way that Takana Shum really worked was on the basis of this premise that it was a commitment by the husband that once he would receive the Yerusha, he would give it to his wife's family. If she passed away within the first couple of years of the marriage. Pashtus is You know, first of all, we don't really seem to practice Takana Shum Bechlal, as far as I can tell, even though it's quoted by the Raman, Simon Nun Gimel Sif Gimel. But Pashtus is that to the degree that Takana Shum would be operative, it would be based on something like the Avodah Sagirshuni, that it's like a built-in Tanai, that it's deemed that at the time of the Erisin, there is this waiver or Tanai, which is made. And that's like a Tanai Bezdin on some level. That's what I would think. The best solution is to do a mamish the way it's supposed to be done. To just have it done between the Eris and Nisun. The Chavos Yair brings a suggestion, I think also from the Avodah Segirshuni, that maybe you can stretch out the definition of Nisun. Nisun isn't necessarily the moment in which the Sheva Brachos are said under the Chuppah. Nisuin could be understood as extending until they come into the Yichud room, and not even necessarily that it's the moment in which they enter into the Yichud room, but it's the moment in which they do the most important act, which is they're in the Yichud room and they eat something. So until the moment in which they actually eat something, so they sit down and they sign this Shtar Siluk, this waiver document, so up until that moment in time it could still be Chal. So the suggestion, obviously, for anyone who would be entering into this type of a prenuptial agreement is either to orchestrate it, that it will be actually signed discreetly, Bein Eris and Nisuin. In many of the cases that they're signing it, it's a second marriage. So it's a Zivig Sheni for both the husband and the wife, and sometimes those are small marriages. You know, sometimes you have a minyan mitzumtzum. You could do it without it creating a great fanfare. Or to do it in such a way that it's after the reading of the Tanaim at the Chassan's Tish, so you satisfy at least the Ksam Sofer, you build in, I'm doing this, but open a mole, be deemed as if I repeated this, B'Shas Erisin, and you do all those bells and whistles, and maybe even for further cover, you say, and I'm committing myself that at the time in which the Misa will occur, I will proactively give away these assets to the wife's family, so that there's also a fulfillment of the Shita Saramban, even though the Shita Saramban was really only stated in the case that there was already a Nisuin, but it seems to me that maybe it would have some value even if one made that commitment, Kodim L'Shas Maise as well. So I'll just finish up with a little bit of Drush, which is that the conclusion of Sefer B'Midbar, we have Tanai B'nei Gad U'B'nei Ruvain. And we learn a lot of the halachos of Tanaim from B'nei Gad and B'nei Ruvain and so forth. And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, yeah, because this is a case of Tanai Shebimamon, Tosis and Kiddushin, Mem Tes Amid Beis also says it's a Tanai Shebimamon. The question is, what kind of Tanai Shebimamon? So I don't know how to get out of that. According to the Rambam, who says any inyan of Yerusha is a chukas mishpat, but clearly the Nachlas Eretz Yisrael is an inyan of Yerusha. The Rambam talks about the Rashi in B'Midbar and Parshas Pinchas. The famous Rashi talks about how this Yerusha is different from other Yerushas, that the Mesim are Yoresh Sachayim, but the Maisa, it's certainly an inyan of Yerusha. And if you hold normally, you can't make a Tanai be Yerusha. How can you make such a Tanai? So the answer is, you can't make a Tanai be Yerusha. As a general proposition, there are technical problems that for a Tanai be Yerusha, namely that you can't give away that which you already was zocha to have, but it's not actually in your possession, or it's a milsa de mimelo, things of that variety. However, as we've seen, that even when you might have a viable Yerusha, like Yerusha Sabal Nivyoladitz Daraisa, if it's a moment in time in which you haven't yet been zoicha, but you're still shayach to it, so that you you're in the parsha, but it hasn't yet come into your hands, so then we say that nachla haba liadam mimakom achir masne alav shlo yirashena, that you can make a tanai that even with respect to a nachla, if it hasn't come yet, that under certain circumstances maybe you wouldn't inherit it. So when was the tanai made with respect to the Bnei Gad, Bnei Ruvain? It happens that they were interested in Eir HaYarden, but it's of significance that they made the tanai dafka during that period of time. Because that period of time, when they entered into the Eir HaYarden, what was the status? They weren't yet in Eretz Yisrael, but they were partially in Eretz Yisrael. So the Rashi writes in B'Midbar Chav Zayin, Pasuk Yud Beis, that Moshe Rabbeinu already was like a little encouraged, because it's like the child that was told he's not allowed to enter the palace, but he enters the antechamber of the palace, kishenichnas the kiton hamelech, and he's standing right at the doorway of the paltin shalom, of the palace itself, of the actual room of the king, and he's about to enter into the palace gates. So he thinks that maybe he'll have a chance that he will be allowed into the royal chamber, and he said, nope, you can't go any further. You can go into the antechamber, but you can't actually go into the royal chambers. Tashbetz puts it, the Eber Yardin is Kedusha Sa'aretz, but not yet the Kedusha Shechina, not yet the full-fledged Kedusha Sa'aretz. That explains why Bedavka, even though this was an Inyan of Yerusha, normally you can't make a Tanai in Yerusha, but just like the husband can make the Tanai Ben Eris in the Nisuin when he hasn't yet been Zoycha, so too B'nai Yisrael, the Tzmigai of B'nai Reuven, I'm sorry. Who says they? No, they hadn't entered into Eretz Yisrael. Yeah, but they're making a Tanai, even with respect to... No, they say, if we don't do it, though, then we'll just get the regular Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah, but they're making the Tanai with respect to both the Nachla in Eretz Yisrael and here. But they're saying that if we do follow this Tanai, then we won't get that Yerusha. We're going to give up that Yerusha in Eretz Yisrael. They're making the Tanai right now that if we don't do this, we're not going to get that Yerusha. If we do this... We'll get the Yerusha here, and we won't get the Yerusha in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, they were able to do it precisely at that moment in time, because that was the equivalent of Ben Eris and Lenisuan.